Hello, welcome to The Do Podcasts with me, Gav Thompson. We are the new podcast series from The Do Lectures. The Do Lectures is an idea-sharing event set up in a chicken shed in Wales in 2007 with a simple brief to inspire and encourage people. My job here is to bring to life the essence of The Do Lectures, but in a new podcast format. Season 1 of my podcast is all about the story behind the person and the person behind the story. The headlines of my story? I'm a father of three lovely kids, a proud husband to my gorgeous wife, Karina, a cancer survivor, I've worked for 13 years in advertising, and another 13 years in marketing, the last five as a chief marketing officer. I'm the founder of GiftGaff, but I'm currently unemployed. You can see more of my story in my own Do Lecture from 2012. The Do Lectures have had over 150 million views of their lectures online, but have never branched out into podcasts. Clearly, I have some way to go to get to 150 million listens to my podcasts, but that mission starts here. Please enjoy. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 6, Compassionate Leadership with Manly Hopkinson. Manly has led a remarkable life. He has filled more into his life so far than many do in many lifetimes. He started off life in the British Navy. He served in the First Gulf War. He was an inspector in the Royal Hong Kong Police, and he then continued in business before becoming an adventurer and explorer. Two significant things stand out. Firstly, he captained a yacht in the BT Global Round the World Yacht Race. This was a 9-month, 32,000-mile odyssey made somewhat more challenging as they were sailing the wrong way round the world. He will explain more in a minute. And then at the opposite end of the time and scale, and perhaps my own personal favourite because it sounds like my idea of hell, is that Manly won the inaugural race to get to the magnetic North Pole. His record of 10 days and 9 hours still stands today. As well as facing temperatures of minus ridiculous, he also had a face-to-face Mexican standoff with a rather large polar bear. All that experience makes him very qualified to talk about his current work and area of expertise, which is leadership, and in particular, compassionate leadership. He now advises many businesses, large and small, on how to be better leaders. Manly really is one of the most incredible and impressive and manly men that I have ever met. So sit back, relax, wrap up warm, and enjoy. You're called Manly.
Yes.
I assume after the poet, Manly Hopkins.
Sure, Manly Hopkins, yeah.
Yeah, I studied English, so I know a bit about him. So I'm just wondering, with my nominative determinism hat on, just tell me about being called Manly.
Well, before I was born, I was going to be called Julian, actually. And my,
you're not a Julian.
Well,
man.
There we go. My mother spotted that. My father was my dad was Navy, and he was away at sea when I came out. My mum just took one look at me. And I must have been an ugly baby because she just said, I'm not calling him Julian, he's called Boy. So for the first 4 weeks of my life, I was just called Boy.
Okay.
Until my father came home and he'd been reading some Gerard Manley Hopkins, my mother had. And actually his boss at the time, so slightly sycophantic, was called Admiral Sir Manley Power. And that's a yes,
that's
sir kind of name, isn't
name.
It? You imagine
Manley
that.
Power.
You don't muck around with that. And they said, well, look, this will sort the sod out. Let's call him Manley. At school, it was slightly hard because I didn't really grow any height until I was about 16, 17. So
right.
When I was 15 years old at school, I was a bit of a short ass and with a big nose and a silly name. So it was ripe for a bit of ribbing. But then you see, maybe that made me the character I am, that, you know, ribbing is fine in its own right, doesn't really worry. I mean, there's womanly and not so manly and all the variations.
It's such a great, it's a great name that with hindsight defines a lot of what you've done, right? When I was at school, my school report said he doesn't want to play sport, he wants to pick flowers, right? Now, Gavin's just a bit of a rubbish name, but for me, I should have been called kind of Mincy or something like that.
I like to pick flowers too, or just smell the flowers rather than pick them,
to be honest.
I was too busy
picking them too.
Exactly, I don't want to pick them, leave them where they are, admire the beauty.
Well, of course, but to be called Manly, I think there is a certain expectation that you're going to do what, guess what, you've gone and done, which is amazing.
I think, without doubt, I'm sure, even though you can look at it retrospectively. It definitely, your background makes you who you are. But my parents' attitude was one that it was very much a case of, yeah, be free, say yes, you know, have the courage to live your own life, which is what I do now with my children. And I think I've always had that encouragement to go out and do stuff. And it doesn't matter if you make a mistake, just sort it out, and then off you go. And so, yeah, that leads to you doing stuff, I guess.
So the two sort of obvious big things that we should talk about, you've skipped a ship going the wrong way around the world, which I think
makes me sound like an idiot when you say going the wrong way around the world. Yeah. Everyone else went the right way, but Manly went the wrong way.
We'll explain that in a second. I think someone somewhere said there's more people been on the moon or...
Yeah, more people. Yeah, it's very rare.
Yeah, it's very rare
indeed.
And secondly, you're one of a team of three people that hold the current world record for getting to the magnetic North Pole.
Yes.
Because you weren't an Arctic explorer, right?
No.
So tell me about how that happened.
So I've skied, but I didn't ski all my life. I came to skiing later on and downhill skiing, and I'd never done any cross-country skiing. I was working with a couple of amazing guys, actually, a guy, Chris McLeod and Rob Lewis. They're a brilliant organisation. Still friends now, and they're still working, called Mission Performance, doing really great stuff. We've been using the story of the Global Challenge, the racing and the sailing, for a while, the leadership, and we were just having a beer thinking, come on, we need to do more stuff. And, yeah, 3 months before taking part in the race to the Magnetic North Pole, I'd never put on a pair of cross-country skis before in my life.
But what gave you the belief or self-belief that you could possibly even achieve it or win it?
Now, that's a really good question, because I actually tell that story a lot with people, because we don't know until we try is the reality. So, yeah, I've got a bit of inner confidence, or it might be stupidity, or it might be ignorance, whatever it may be. But I was with two Royal Marines, and they were pretty handy guys, Phil Ashby and Chris McLeod, bloody good skiers as well, 8 years younger than me, really, really fit. And so they were my tutors for a while, and I've worked out that the Royal Marines don't understand the word sympathy. It's not in their dictionary at all. Apparently, if you're looking for it in the dictionary, it is. It's in between shit and syphilis, but you may want to cut that one out.
Just leave it in for now.
And we just said, yeah, let's do it. But it's an interesting point there, because I was determined that I wasn't going to be the weak link. So, yeah, I trained and I got myself fit, but most of the things are mental rather than physical. And so I made a commitment to myself and to the lads. I said, look, boys, I'm going to do everything in my power that you will never, ever have to say, hurry up, Manly. And that was for me as well as for them. And it was brilliant, because for me, I had it within me that I'd made a commitment to myself and to the team.
Yeah.
And they also were brilliant because they respected it. They recognised where it came from. There was a deep inner intent that they were never to say, hurry up, Manly. And I remember there's one time middle of the race, and it's always halfway, it's the hardest time, isn't it? Because the novelty factor's gone. And I was feeling sorry for myself, which I think is the worst human emotion ever. And I just couldn't get warm. And I was going, I just said, look, treat this well. So at that particular time, right, I was feeling sorry for myself. And I was slowing down. Then I looked up and I saw the two guys 200 metres ahead of me. And I thought, any moment now, they're going to say, hurry up, Manly. And that was enough of a jolt to get me to pull my finger out, hurry up, catch up with them, say, hi, guys, lovely day. Come on, let's crack on. And I think that commitment, that sense of verbalising your commitment is really important. So I know I could do it? No, I didn't.
Do you ever wonder before, during or after why they said yes to go with you? Because they could have picked another Marine.
Yeah, they could have done, actually, three Marines. One of the things I could bring was a different view, because that wasn't my universe. So I could bring my complete universe, which is sailing. And I did a lot of work on the nutrition and the physiology and then the psychology of performance. And when you're at ocean for months on end, you can do that. It also enabled me to ask the stupid questions. And I'm also not a bad navigator. I can generally find my way around. So quite handy skills that I had. But you're right, they could have asked somebody else. I've never asked them that question, actually.
There you go. And I love the fact that you, in the pub, over a beer, went, yeah, I'll crack on to the North Pole. Secondly, you managed to find a bunch of people who were prepared to go with you. And thirdly, the crazy bit, which I wanted to tell me about, is you won, got the world record, and you still got the world record many years later. How come?
Well, we did it in 10 days and 9 hours. And my understanding, the closest is about 13 days. What we did is we fundamentally challenged the existing ways of doing things. The sun normally goes up and down, doesn't it? Roughly once every 24 hours or thereabouts, pretty close. I didn't want 24 hours in a day. We would be using about 10,000 calories in a day, but we can only eat around about 8,500. Your body can't assimilate anymore. And if we were marching for full, if we were using full 24 hours, then we'd have to march about 16 hours And what happens is your body deteriorates exponentially. It'll knock itself down with overexertion and not enough food. It'll start dropping off. And then if you keep doing it, it'll drop off quicker and quicker and quicker. So there's a sweet spot where you want to stop beating yourself up.
Right.
And it's also the same as sleep. And it may sound crazy, because if we did 24 hours, we'd have to sleep for about 6 hours or so. And that wouldn't work either, because your body atrophies. What happens is the logic of your body says, that was a really tough day and I didn't get enough food. So what I'm going to do in the meantime, whilst Manly's sleeping, I'm going to preserve all that lovely fat around the middle and I'm going to eat muscle groups that Manly's not using. So your body will always break down muscle first before it breaks down fat. So if you're trying to lose weight, you've got to do it with exercise and diet, not just diet. We worked out that we wanted to do a 20-hour day.
Okay.
20 hours gave us 13 hours of marching. And then it gave us 2 hours to sort of melt ice for water, sort your food out, repair your equipment, prepare yourself, 4 hours of sleep, which is long enough to get a couple of cycles of REM and NREM sleep, but not too long in body atrophies, 1 hour to put it all back in one sock, off and off you go for 13 hours. So we ran a 20-hour day. It was brilliant. It was amazing. It challenged everything. But people still aren't doing that. They're still stuck. I mean, there's so many bloody lessons in this. And this lesson about, you know, Einstein said a definition of insanity is doing the same thing, expecting a different result, isn't it? This is the point, is that if we want to make a step change, you can't do it by iteration. You can't do it by just gradually doing small bits, even marginal gains of Dave Brailsford and like, brilliant, but it only gets you to the peak. If there's a trough before the bigger peak, you'll never get there through iteration. You've got to make a step change. You've got to challenge existing to such a degree that no one else is doing it. There was another team who also set out to win. Team of two, so more agile, takes less time to melt the ice for water and this sort of stuff. So they were a good threat. Led by an army commando, which is an interesting concept in his own right. So he's army, but with the Royal Marines, Green Beret as well. And the number two is a chap called Richard Dunwoody. Now, you'll know of Richard, champion jump jockey. So this was a new thing for him, but he's fit as a butcher's dog, yeah. As the expression goes.
And also light as hell.
Light as hell, but also he's got the mindset of a champion. So our strategy was 20 hours a day. And then we also broke it up brilliantly. And this is another key lesson I need to share because it's so important, right? What is success in winning all about? Because we can all say we want to win, yeah? Easiest thing to say in the world, but how do you live winning? So one part of living winning is challenging. That 20-hour day is one part. Another part we did was we split the day into 90 minutes nonstop and a break, 90 minutes and a break. 90 minutes you could break down to three easily. And breaking things down was useful, but it's the breaks. And this was the key thing. So if I said to you now we're having a 5 or 10 minute break, I mean, how long is a 5 or 10 minute break? When we had our breaks on the ice, our breaks were 7 minutes.
On the nail?
On the nail. We never, ever broke our 7 minute rule. It's exact, it's angular, it's a prime number. And the 7 minute was also the external manifestation of our internal discipline. And this internal discipline is the baseline, the foundation for success and anything you want to do and achieve. If you don't have the internal self-discipline to do what has to happen, nothing changes, nothing goes. So the bit about the team was, we set off and they actually just tucked in behind us. So we put on a burst of speed and they just stuck with us. We slowed right down, I thought we were waving past, and they just slowed right down and waved back. Their strategy is even simpler. What they were going to do was just to follow us. We could see them all the time. So they'd be putting us under so much psychological pressure. We'd also be breaking the ice. So we'd be making the tracks,
yes.
All the extra effort and energy. Yeah. They'd just follow our tram lines and before the finish line, just overtake us and off he goes. Hey, thanks.
Great strategy.
Brilliant strategy.
Brilliant.
Absolutely good.
But what happened?
Didn't work there. Because it didn't work again because we challenged doing the normal thing, right? So it's bloody cold out there. You get wind chill taking
I can imagine.
Yeah. You get wind chill taking it to minus 60. So you're still air temperature, you know, minus 30, 34, this sort of stuff. So any exposed flesh and bits just fall off in minutes or seconds if you're not careful. But you also, the biggest problem when you're marching is heat, believe it or not. So you're not wearing a great deal. You've got a thin base layer and a little nylon shell suit covered in zip so you can vent, and that's it. But your hands and head and your face and your nose, all covered. But when you stop, you freeze quickly. So you've got to either put some clothes on very quickly or put your tent up. And there was a certain time every day where you had to make a satellite telephone call back to base, A, to say where you are, you're still alive, you haven't been eaten by polar bears, and hurrah, and off you go. We were marching on, giving it snacks, the polar team, Tony Martin and Rich Dunwoody just behind us, and the time comes to make our call. So we think, right, well, we need to put the tent up because it takes a while to get it sorted. So we stopped to put the tent up, they stopped to put their tent up, 200 metres behind us. This is the difference, right? We made it look as though we did a proper job with our tent. So the bit they could see, we made it look brilliant. And we spent our time around the back end. And we could see them walking all the way around their tent, bedding it in, knowing that as soon as they got inside, the first thing they'd do is put on the stoves for melt ice for water. And also, because it's minus 30 outside, it's minus 29 three quarters inside. And so as soon as they got inside, we heard them put on the stoves. We broke our tent down and shot off. We thought, sorry, we haven't done our 20 hours yet. We're just going to leave them behind. And you imagine the scene, right? So we quickly made our radio call. Yeah, we're fine. We're here. Everything great. And then crispy snow, scrunchy tent, a lot of ice, a lot of noise, trying to be as quiet as possible. And we just marched off. And then we stopped later on. And that was enough of a trick.
But presumably you can only play that trick a few times.
We only had to do it once because one of the other factors that limits how long you can march in those conditions is how long you can keep water in your thermos flask before it freezes. And we had the best thermos flask out there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But if the water freezes inside the flask, that's it.
Stuck.
You have to throw the flask away. You'll never, ever get the ice out until you take it back to England. And so you're then carrying a 2 kilogram dead weight with you.
Right.
And you also lost the capacity to store ice. And so it was funny, the next day, you know, we did our 4 hours sleep, got up, and we could see this dot on the horizon behind, which is them. They weren't 200 meters behind. They were now a couple of miles behind us. And that was perfect. Then we had the time for our 20 hours at the end of the second day. They never caught up because they'd obviously started earlier than us. Then they couldn't carry on as long as us. So we'd now broken the cycle. When it came to camping the second day, we checked the navigation. We worked out we only got 15 miles to the checkpoint. So we have to stop at a checkpoint as a safety principle. And we decided to press on. So we didn't even stop the second night. And this is a funny story as well because I was in charge of navigation and put it all in the GPS coordinates, this sort of stuff. We pressed on for that final 15 miles. Thinking, yeah, it's great. Toughest 15 miles of my life. We were now running out of energy so badly. Our blood sugar levels were completely screwed up. You know, Chris sort of fell over at one stage and we're hallucinating. So every bit of ice looked like a polar bear or a tombstone or something like that. And eventually we know that the checkpoint is in a place called Polaris, which is actually an old uranium mine. They were just decommissioning. And so it's a funny thing though, isn't it, right? Our energy was dropping, getting slower and slower. We're having to put on our coats and our gloves because we're just not creating enough heat. And you're thinking, oh no, we've overcooked it. We're not going to get it. And then we've gone too far. Then you see the Polaris, the mine building, and the energy floods back. It's all mental.
It's so mental, isn't it? It's
mental.
Psychological.
It's all mental and psychological. Yeah. You can do so much more mentally. And that's why being older helps for these kind of things because you've got that mental toughness and resilience, which you don't necessarily have as a young Turk. But then it got to the bit where we're there and the boys said, Manny, where's the checkpoint? And I checked the GPS and it said, we've still got another mile to go. And I said, no, boys, we've still got another mile to go. I'm thinking, mate, have I got it right? Because now we're leaving Polaris behind. And the two Marines looked at me and said, Manly, if you've screwed up the navigation, no one's going to hear you scream out here. And so for the next mile, we pressed on, not a single sound.
Awkward mile.
A very, very awkward mile indeed. And we got to the point where the GPS said, this is it. And I said, guys, this is it. And I was also full of self-doubt, thinking, Manly, have you just screwed up? Have you ruined it?
You ruined it, yeah.
And as we put up our tent in total silence, they were sharpening their knives, ready to disembowel them. An aeroplane circled overhead and landed. And we'd gone so fast that we'd beaten the race organisers into checkpoint one.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, it was great. It was great. But we shook off that team and they never caught up.
They never caught up. Presumably the South Pole has to be on the agenda at some point.
Well, I've been trying to get south for a couple of years, but I do have a very exciting adventure coming up at the end of next year.
Go on.
There's a place called Heard Island.
Yep.
So between Cape Town and Australia and Antarctica and just the belly button of the Indian Ocean,
right off the coast
of Antarctica is Heard Island.
So it's
a single volcano.
Right.
And it's a volcanic peak. It's covered in 31 glaciers. It goes from sea level to 3,000 metres in a single cone. It's live. It's called Big Ben. And it's never, ever been skied before. I was skiing last year in Kyrgyzstan, right on the Chinese border, middle of nowhere. Our guide was an amazing fellow called Peter Spreisnik, completely barking mad, beautiful man. And we were sitting in the yurt having a beer at the end of an amazing week doing some mountains in Kyrgyzstan and talking about dreams and where you want to go and what you want to do next.
Yeah.
He was just saying, yeah, you know, man, there's this place which you'll be... And this guy jumps off mountains and cliffs and avalanches and it's ridiculous.
That's his thing.
Yeah, unbelievable thing. So we're chatting and he said, look, Manny, there's a place I want to go to which I know I'll never get there. It's a live stream, but I know I'll never achieve it. And he described Heard Island. And I said, well, where is it? He says, yeah, this is where it was, roughly. I said, well, look, tell you what, mate, I'm a skipper, I'm a captain, I'll take you there. But the deal is, if I take you there, you've got to get me up the hill and back down again. He goes, whoa, man, shit, yeah, you're a skipper. And that's it, we shook hands. And that was a couple of years ago. And there's a beautiful, beautiful synergy. I've got to tell you this. This is just fantastic, right? So there I was thinking, well, I've got to get this going, trying to find the boat, because you know you can't be a motorboat. It's got to be a sailing boat. We're going to use a lot of science as well. We're going to use it for social mobility and all sorts of brilliant things. And then I stumbled across the exact same yacht that I took around the world 20 years ago in the Global Challenge is now being run by an amazing organization called Challenge Wales, who take young kids out and help them discover a sense of self-worth and self-reliance. And they do brilliant, brilliant stuff. And I had a chat with them, said, look, you don't use it in the winter, can I borrow it? And they said, yeah, we'll take it down to Cape Town. We'll do the final stocking of wine and biltong in Cape Town. And then we'll poodle down to Heard Island, a couple of weeks to get there. We'll spend a couple of weeks there. We'll do a lot of scientific stuff as well. Plastic in the oceans, ocean temperature, ozone layers, fauna and flora, this sort of stuff. Then we're going to go around the corner, position the magnetic South Pole, because that's in the water at the moment. It's actually not on land. The magnetic
moves,
South Pole.
Right? I mean, I vaguely know that from my geography lessons.
And it wiggles around a bit.
Wiggles around, yeah.
And it hasn't been positioned, I think, since 2014. So we're going to go position the magnetic South. Then I've done magnetic North. And magnetic surf.
Oh, nice.
And then
there you go.
Back home to Cape Town in time for team medals.
No one's done both magnetics.
Not as far as I can work out. They haven't done both magnetics.
Claim it.
Well, I think
as
I
you
might,
will.
Well, I may not claim it as such because it's about 3,000 metres down.
So, yes, let's jump to the other amazing achievement. Sailing round the world the wrong way round.
Yeah.
32,000 miles, 9 months. Just give us a flavour of what that was like.
Yeah, and the wrong way, that means going west.
Yeah, so winds, the currents.
Yeah, winds and currents all come from the west. As we know here, you know, winds.
Because the earth spins
UK,
one way, you're going the other
way. Yeah, and generally, well, the currents do work different ways, but different bands. So right. the North Atlantic, the Gulf Stream comes from the west, and when you go, then we go north-south, basically. We go round Cape Horn, going towards the west, towards the gales. These incredible storms just circle the globe around Antarctica with nothing to stop them.
Yeah.
And the Southern Ocean Drift is also coming from the west. So it's an amazing place. And, you know, you're thousands of miles away from land. It's beautiful. That's why it's called the world's toughest yacht race. Set up an amazing man called Sir Che Blythe, who the first time he did it single-handed nonstop. But what I also really appreciate from Che was that his premise was it's all about attitude, not ability. And I absolutely believe him.
Yeah.
Because what made this race all so extraordinary was that the crew were amateurs from all walks of life all over the world. And my crew was 17. 8 of my crew had never, ever sailed before in their life.
Which is crazy.
It's brilliant. So, but this is all about attitude. But I think life is about attitude. The danger with ability is, or expert, is that we stop listening, we stop learning, we stop receiving feedback. We think we know, we understand.
Yeah.
I always say there's no energy in knowing. The energy is in learning. And if you've got people and they're taking on the world's toughest yacht race and never sailed before, it's just magnificent.
It's amazing. It's,
and he was absolutely right. And testimony to how right he was is that you're racing 12 identical boats as well, by the way.
Right.
So there's no difference from one boat to the next. And you don't select your own crew. They select the crew to balance them. So you've got 12 equal crews of amateurs from all over the world, all their walks of life.
So there's 12 skippers.
Yep.
And they go, right, this is your boat, this is your crew. Just crack on.
Do it, crack on. And right. By the way, if you whinge too much, Skipper, I can fire you because you've been paid. I can't get rid of the crew because they're paying. It's a lovely dynamic there as well. And it's a beautiful one. And so what was amazing was you race across an ocean, so you have a really tight start. And then as you hit the ocean, so the boats drift apart. And you may see each other mid-ocean as you... But then as you approach the other side of the ocean and you're coming into the harbour, the boats are neck and neck. So they're neck and neck, so, having raced for 36, 37 days. This is closer racing than Formula One Grand Prix. They may only win by hundredths of a second, but they've only been going for 2 hours. You've been going for over a month. You're dueling and fighting as you're coming up to the finish line.
Does your boat tell you where the others are? Do you have that kind of GPS?
Yeah, every 6 hours. Every six
okay,
hours, the
so
boats
you know
are
where
pulled.
They are. Right.
And that is beautiful as well, because you see where you are.
And that must help, back to the psychology bit, the mind bit. I mean, that must be very important.
I tell you what's interesting is that if you're chasing the leader, you're thinking, great, I'm getting close, I'm getting close. When you are the leader, which did happen to me, not all the time, unfortunately, but it did happen, the pressure's tenfold. Because now you know everyone's looking at you.
Yeah.
And it's yours to lose. So when you're second, third or fourth, it's still yours to win.
Yeah.
And actually not doubting yourself, but still being brave enough to do courageous decisions rather than just be too conservative. Because they're going to try anything behind you. Yeah. But if you're just doing that conservative line, trying to protect your lead, you lose it. And there's so many lessons in life about that. And actually, it was Rudyard Kipling, the poem If. Yeah. And I love it. And there's two lines that if you can treat with the triumph and disaster as twin imposters, because they are. Now, disaster can work against you because it knocks your confidence. It's failure.
Yeah.
And success can work against you because it stops you trying and challenging. You get complacent. And the trick is to not have the complacency, to keep challenging yourself when you're doing well, keep learning, keep growing. Don't just do normal and boring. And when you make a mistake, well, that's an investment in learning. It's brilliant. After the race, I got into speaking and leadership, obviously, because you learn a lot.
Yeah.
Then over the years, as you're working with more and more leaders globally and getting more senior as well, you're challenging yourself about what do we do about how we develop leaders, but also what is the point of it? What are we trying to achieve? Because I can see so much compliance. I don't mean governance compliance, which is a good thing if you're in the chemical industry or whatever. But I mean reluctance within the workforce.
So let me just clarify. So you're my boss. You've told me to do this. I'll do it because you're my boss.
Yeah, because you're my boss. Exactly. So I have to do it because otherwise you'll beat me up. Or if I do do it, you'll reward me. So we create a transaction. So it's transactional. It's compliant, whatever. And I worked out that actually what we need to do, the outcome of leadership should be to gain commitment.
Right.
If I ask you now, right, Gav, there's something I want you to do and you don't want to do it, right? You don't want to do it, but I'm saying you've got to do it. How do you feel?
Not great.
No.
I would slightly resent you for asking me to do it. I'd probably do it, but I will do it in a slightly half-assed way.
Exactly.
Because you told me to.
What if I now ask you to do something and you want to do it?
I'll knock it out of the park.
Yeah, totally. And this is the point, isn't it? We waste so much human energy at work. I mean, we're wasting a ridiculous amount of energy on the planet anyway, but the human energy lost at work is disengagement. Because we created a compliant transactional relationship with the workforce. We're losing that sense of meaning and purpose and duty to what we're doing. We have this command and control and autocratic style of leadership. And it's wrong, fundamentally wrong. Let's get commitment, right? Because if I've got your commitment, I've got your engagement. I've got communication. I've got collaboration. I've got your innovation because you come up with ideas. I've got resilience. I've got your well-being. I've got your happiness. And guess what? I've got performance at the end of the day. So rather than chase the scoreboard, let's work with the team on the pitch about gaining commitment. And this is my challenge. So then you think, oh, great, sounds good. So we've got to get commitment. Right. Okay. So how do we get commitment?
Yeah.
Where does commitment come from? And so then I did a lot of work on the psychology of commitment. And this also came from my adventures, my expeditions as well. Commitment comes from a sense of self-worth. That if you can see your journey, if I'm asking you to do something and it fulfills you as a person, because it's your journey as well, you can see, yeah, Manny wants me to do that. Well, it's great because I want to do it anyway.
Yeah.
That's commitment.
Yeah.
And that gives you everything else.
Yeah.
So commitment's about self-worth. And then you go back and look at the neural physiology, how the brain maps self-worth. And it goes way back to your eight-year-old child, your core self, when your value set was fixed. That's what we've got to tap into. So then you work out, so how do we tap into self-worth? And actually, and I've got a lot of inspiration over the years from the Dalai Lama. And I use his expression of compassion, which is why my work now is around compassionate leadership, where he talks about compassion being understanding with positive action. He talks about empathy first, but he says empathy is to understand. It's not the emotional response of empathy, because I think that can be negative. It's the knowledgeable element of empathy. The more I understand you, and then I work with that knowledge in a positive way, well, that's going to be a good thing. That means I'm going to tap into your self-worth. Sure. So as a definition of leadership then, compassionate leadership, is to secure the best for all. And I heard leaders all over the world trying to increase productivity, increase efficiency, increase effectiveness. And all they're doing is squeezing, 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 squeezing till they throttle the life out of the organization and the people. And my challenge to leaders is, no. Secure the best for your people first. Because if I secure the best for you, I guarantee I'll get the best out of you. Because if I can secure the best for you, I've got your commitment. If I've got your commitment, the rest follows. It also means, by the way, we've got to secure the best for ourselves as leaders, because the danger is in our desire to serve other people, the organization, our families, our communities, we compromise ourselves first. Compassion has to start at home. We have to be self-compassionate. I need to understand Manly and be nice to what I find, you know, warts and all.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the key element. I then need to make sure that the all is not just my people, it's the supplier, the customer, but guess what? It's got to be the planet too. So compassionate leadership then becomes a whole way of thinking, which is about, I'm going to try and get the best for all the people that I touch, everywhere I touch, the planet and everything. And actually, because of my effort to get the best for people, I will get the best out of them. And so that's the principle. And that's what compassionate leadership is born. And what's been beautiful is that working with business leaders and community leaders and some sporting teams as well, literally over the world over the years, getting them to be compassionate first, understanding with positive action. So deeply understand who they really are, who the 8-year-old self is, because that's the person I want to work with. I don't want to work with this other person, which may well be a facade. I want to work with the core Gav. You know, who is the real Gav? Who's the real Manny? Because that's where we're going to relate. That's where we're going to influence, build a relationship, start leading, all that sort of stuff. Once you work with this group of people, you fundamentally shift their whole thinking, their whole attitude, inside work and outside of work as well. So my life's purpose is to create this movement of compassion and compassionate leadership globally. I'm focusing on industry first because from a congregational perspective, it's the biggest church. You know, we all go to work. So let's work there. It's also where the biggest dysfunction is, and we spend a lot of time working compared to else places. And the dysfunction has come from many historical reasons. So let's challenge that. Let's create compassionate workplaces. And what is lovely is that, you know, my book was published in 2014, my online academy in 2018. So I've been talking and working in the field of compassion for many, many years. What I'm really pleased to see is that the discussion of compassion is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The voice of compassion is growing. People are looking for a greater sense of meaning, a greater sense of commitment and connection. They don't want to just follow the path that their parents or grandparents followed of working for the machine. I want a sense of purpose and meaning. And we can do that. And if we do that, we're in a better place. If I'm compassionate, I'm in a good place myself.
So, Manny, one of the things I really like that you've spoken about is how you want to get people back to their 8-year-old self.
Yeah.
Just tell the listeners more about that.
That's fundamental. So let's look about what happens when we're born. So there's this 0 to 4 and 4 to 8 are the fundamental years where we work out who we are. So when we're born, we're pretty useless. Baby zebra can run as fast as mother within 90 seconds. It knows how to suckle. It knows what is a threat, knows what isn't a threat. We're pretty empty. But we're making about 6 million new neural connections every waking second for the first 4 years of our life. So our brain is empty and it just fills up this incredible amount of information, just absorbs everything. And you think about the learning we've done in the first 4 years, even just language is extraordinary. And then what happens is, between 4 and 8, we then filter that. We work with all that experience and work out a way of dealing with the world, which essentially is working out our ego. There used to be an old Jesuit saying, give me a child at 8 and I'll give you the adult. And this is the principle. Around 8 years old, we've now defined our way of working with the world. And so our ego then is set, our values are set, our core sense of who we are is now fixed. And it's written in a subconscious manner, deep within our brain. And it won't change. There's a little bit of malleability around teenage years. But apart from that, that is you. Gav is Gav, Manly yeah. is Manly, yeah. Full stop. Now, that's where self-worth comes from. It's from that person there. But the problem happens is around 8 years old again, as well as you just deciding who you are in the world and how you're going to fit, you've also suddenly realized that you're being judged. And we have a natural instinctive desire to be part of a group because that's a survival mechanism from millions of years of evolution. And so rather than just being true to ourselves, we now say, what's expected of me? What does mummy expect? What does daddy expect? What does school expect? What does church expect? What does society expect? And we end up being dragged further and further away from who we are by the dominant cultures. Now, there's a problem here, particularly as our cultures are quite dominant and quite dysfunctional, as we've discussed yeah. already, that we get dragged away from actually who we are. So now we're operating in a place detached from our sense of self-worth. So I cannot fulfill self-worth, which is self-respect and self-esteem. Self-respect, doing stuff that I value myself for. Self-esteem, being recognized for doing things I value myself for. So now I cannot fulfill that self-worth, so I'm in psychological conflict. And I think that's the problem with the world where we are today. And we see it in road rage. We see it in social media where we're detached from our communication. So all this angst and conflict just comes out. It's vile. But it's there because of the society we've created. Now, when I'm working with leaders and with groups of people, I don't want that dysfunctional human being in the room. I want the 8-year-old kid.
Yeah.
That is the real person. So through the powerful use of metaphor and story, and it's a beautiful process, I get them to reflect on who they really are at an eight-year-old level and bring that to the surface and share it with their mates. And then it's just fantastic because from that moment, the people go, and I say, which words do you want to change now? And they go, well, no, that's me. This is what I want to be like. I want to live like that. Because that's my inner self. So then what we need to create is recognizing that I can't just be their eight-year-old manly. I've got responsibilities. But what I can create is what I call a conscious compromise. So I know deeply who I am. Remember, compassion is understanding with positive action. So I'm compassionate to myself. I know manly at a deep core level. You know, what are his values? What are his belief systems? You know, what is it that motivates him or doesn't motivate him? And I may not be able to live 100% on that line, but I can live close enough. And it's conscious, my gap. And that's what we need to work with. And so this is the key thing. So we need to help everybody bring their eight-year-old child to work. I don't mean their eight-year-old kid. I mean their eight-year-old self to work. It'll be shambles if you want their eight-year-old kid to work. But I want people to bring their eight-year-old child, the real you, because that's the person that I can relate with. That's the person that gives me commitment. That's the person that gives me ideas and innovation and self-worth and happiness and all that stuff is you, your deep you, not this false thing that we've been forced to live.
But when I was an eight-year-old, I was a little bit of a brat.
Well, that's the real you then, Captain, isn't it? Exactly. enough said. Maybe it doesn't work in your case. No, but the point is we are because we're pushing out. We're finding our place and we're pushing. And it's also potentially that time of realization that you're judged. And as we're desiring to be part of a group, we also desire to live our own life. So it creates a natural tension, which you see in those early teens of, I want to be Gav, but I want to be part of the team. I want to be Gab, but I want to be part of the team.
I was a real show-off. And that
creates attention. And part of the shelf may have been about being part of the team, not the real Gab. So it's not a happy place for you either, which is why you may have been pushing back too much. Mm. And so this is the key thing, that what we've got to understand when a child is at that age, that there's a tension growing within them at a psychological and emotional level between who they've defined themselves as now, how they're going to relate to the world, and what we ask of them. That again happens second time in teen years as well, which is a key element. And it's recognizing that's happening within our minds, within our brains at the time, in a way that it can't be stopped, it just is.
Yeah.
And if we're being compassionate with that, understanding with positive action, well, then we can deal with it. And this is the key thing. So it's the eight-year-old child is the one. This exercise I've done, we're using the metaphor and the three particular questions, which is so powerful. I'll invite you to come sailing with me and I'll tell the story very visually, with the video of the global challenge and everything. And the visual bit's important because your brain is looking at it subconsciously as well as you filtering it consciously.
I've seen the video. It scares the shit out of me.
Yeah, some good stuff, isn't it? It really is. And then as you're engrossed in the story and you're now attached to the story subconsciously, I'll stop the story and ask three questions. So you're now with me on this boat. So you're going to invest 9 months of your life. What do you want for yourself? And people will write things down in absolute silence, saying, I want a sense of achievement, a sense of pride, to get out of my comfort zone, to learn, to grow, to connect, to leave a legacy, all these beautiful words. And then the second question will be, well, how are you going to work together on the yacht? And that's where the concept of value words and team words come in. I want a work environment which is tolerant, respectful, supportive, caring, compassionate, but there's discipline and focus too. And then the third question, I say, well, what do you want to achieve? Some will say to win. Some will say to make friends for life. And others will say to learn and grow. And that feeds into inner motivations. And so then we share this, still within the metaphor and the story. And then I say, actually, no, you're not going to serve me around the world. You are the board of this company. You are the leadership team of this company. Which words do you want to change? And that's the breakthrough.
Yeah, no, and we can do that. That's a powerful metaphor.
It's massively powerful. We can do it at every level. And this is what we need to do. I may be in the warehouse, but I've still got an eight-year-old self that needs fulfilling.
I used to be a primary school teacher, and that thing with eight-year-olds, eight, nine-year-olds, they were the best age to teach. You know, I was qualified up to, I think, age 11, but that age, when they have a sense of identity, they've just start to understand things like humour.
Yeah.
They've understand some dynamics. It's just such a lovely time, and I think I've never heard that used as a kind of management metaphor, which is, let's get back there. I think it's really powerful.
It is very powerful, but also, you know, you're born with love and compassion. You're not born with hate and anger.
No.
They come later.
That comes from
society, yeah. From external. And we need to get back to that love and compassion part.
Which, again, I love the metaphor, because actually in doing that, you would break down so much of what's wrong with life today by doing that. You know what I mean?
And it works. The beautiful thing is, once you've got this board of a company, which have been forced to act so far removed from who they really are at a human level, you then get them to be themselves. you change the whole organization because suddenly we want people to be you. I want you to have the courage to be yourself.
Yeah, no,
I want you to bring your 8-year-old self to work. Yeah. Yeah. 8-year-old self to work is so key. Moving forward, I mean, gosh, I've worked with some very cynical groups of people. And the first time you mentioned polar bear, changes their mindset because they're suddenly interested in you. Instead of, I walk into one training room for a particular organization and they wouldn't even look at me. Their arms would be folded and they'd look at the wall. And I'd come in because the last thing you want is a pink, fluffy person talking leadership, fluffiness, tree-hugging.
And your backstory is handy because it's the opposite, right? You're not Mr. Tree-hugger.
I do like hugging trees, actually.
Let's sit around and chant and sing. You've done some quite hardcore stuff.
Yeah, but you need to do both, I think.
And one of the definitions I really like that you've used recently is that, you know, in your mind and in the mind of the future, a billionaire should be not someone who's got a billion units of currency in their bank account. It should be someone that's impacted a billion people's lives in a positive way.
In a positive way, yeah.
Just talk to me a bit about your vision for yourself and your plans.
Yeah, my vision. One of my proudest moments was when my work was recognised by the Dalai Lama, who commended me my work in compassion.
To be fair, that's quite an achievement in itself. Right? Let's pause and reflect that. Well done.
Did you get that one?
We got that.
Good, excellent, nice. But it is, it's really, really meaningful for me because I sincerely want to be a small part in the play to take compassion out to the world. I launched my online academy to do a number of different things. I see some fundamental flaws in the way we teach leadership. What's your sport, Gav?
It used to be rugby.
Okay, let's talk about rugby.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
So let's say you are the rugby coach.
Yep.
And you've got your squad together, beginning of the season, and you say to the squad, right, squad, our challenge this year, we're going to go up a league.
Yep.
So we're going to be brilliant, we're going to thrash everyone, we're going to up a league. And this is my plan to do it. So you've got the whole squad in front of you, about 50-odd players. There's a bell curve of talent, isn't there, by definition?
Always.
A couple of stars, a couple of numpties, and the rest are roughly in the middle.
Yeah.
So what you say is this, right, team, my plan for us to go up a league is this. The group which are quite good, the stars, I'm going to call you my talent group. Actually, I'm only going to coach these 5 people. So the rest of you, I'm not going to coach you in the slightest, but I want your 100% commitment. And to make it even better, I'm going to take these 5 people away from the club and I'm going to plant them in a stately home somewhere. We can do a lot of PowerPoint, a lot of theory. We're going to eat a lot of food, drink some beer and wine, not enough sleep. We're going to build a raft, walk across some hot coals. Meanwhile, you're playing every Saturday and losing because you're now resentful and you've lost your stars. I'll bring them back in and, hey, Preston, we're going to win. Isn't that stupid?
It's right. Very stupid.
But what do we do in industry?
We do that.
Exactly that.
We do
a talent group, which is pre-selected through cognitive bias by the leadership team who are already there.
Mm.
I like beer and rugby. So anyone likes beer and rugby, you're in my talent group.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah.
And so we created a subconscious selection through our own biases. We've then said to everyone else, you've got no future here. And we wonder why employee engagement scores are so low.
Mm.
Whereas my premise is, who are we to decide who's the talent? Yes, I recognise there are succession elements as far as some job roles are concerned, but who's the leadership talent? Why don't we invest in everybody? Why don't we help everybody learn? Because the skills of leadership are the same as life skills. It's relationship. How can I lead if I can't relate? How can I motivate if I don't know your motivation? How can I influence you if I don't know what influences you? Because the danger is all we do it from our own perspective. And that's flawed. Because I like beer and rugby, and I think I'm going to, Gav, tilt, mate, let's go to a rugby game and drink some beer. But you may like hockey and sherry. I don't know. But the point is, all I've done is my own stuff.
Yeah.
And so what we've got to do, we need to break out of that. And we need to be able to create a mechanism which allows absolutely everybody across a whole organization, left to right, up and down, from the CEO to the intern, to engage in development. There's also another flaw. What we tend to do in organizations is to do different leadership courses for different levels. Well, if nothing else, leadership is about vertical communication. So why do that? Surely we want the same language of delegation at the bottom as we do at the top. The same language of motivation at the bottom and the top. Because then we'll talk in the same language. It becomes a lexicon, if you like, of leadership and relationship. And then you think, another thing we do wrong, is we give people the tools of leadership without giving them the mindset of a leader. Now that's rubbish. You could give me a scalpel and a stethoscope. Manny, you're a surgeon, mate. I'm not. I'm not going to understand a bit of the body. Or you can give me a chisel and a lathe and say you're a carpenter, a shipwright. I'm not. I've got to understand the grain and the moisture and the sand content of the wood. But we do that with leadership. Go and do a course on coaching or delegation. It's rubbish.
Yeah.
So what you have to do first is help people get the mindset of a leader. And that's about understanding yourself first. recognizing your backstory, being compassionate with yourself, recognizing your prejudices, your motivations, your values, your beliefs, what made you who you are today, recognizing your story in the moment, what is Gav's story now, but then also projecting forward, well, where do I want to be? What's aligned with my sense of purpose and self-worth? Because once I've gone through that, then I can start wielding the tools of leadership. I can't until that moment. And so you then can look also how we learn, which is short bites. We can't concentrate more than 23 minutes at a time. I'm sorry for people on this little talk.
They can press pause. They can do it by
23 minutes, take a 7-minute break every 20 minutes. Pause. And so that's why we created the Compassion Leadership Academy, and we priced it in a disruptive manner so everybody can do it in an organization. And it's accredited, which is quite nice, by the ILM Level 5, which is brilliant. But it's done so the first 8 modules are all around yourself, building your self-sense of worth and who I am. And then you move into the various tools of leadership, which are the same tools of life skills and relationship. So that is helping me scale and get it out there to a bigger, bigger audience all the time, which is very exciting.
Good for you. Final question.
Yep.
I read it in your book, Porridge and Tabasco. That's just stuck in my mind as a thing. Talk me through that. What was that about?
Well, yeah, this was on the penultimate leg of the race, and we were coming up from Cape Town to La Rochelle, and the idea of the La Rochelle stopover is a very short stop, and only a couple of days from Southampton we finished. So all the boats were going to arrive back at the same time. So it was the final big leg, and we were heading north. You don't take spare food because food weighs. And as we crossed the doldrums, we were looking brilliant. And then we came to Madeira, the island of Madeira.
Good for red wine.
I'm not a bitter or twisted man or anything, but I don't drink Madeira. I don't eat Madeira cake. And I won't go to Madeira, nor will any of my children for 7 generations. But
why? As we approached, it signifies all that was wrong
It does. Madeira is a beautiful place, and I have been there. But as we were approaching Madeira, coming up from the south, it's a big volcano, has a big wind shadow, and you know about that. We were in the lead group of 3 boats, and we were off to the west of the island. The wind was coming in from the east at that time, and we knew that. So we were about 45 miles off Madeira. The 9 boats were trying to squeeze around to the east, were struggling against the wind. The 3 boats at the west, we were looking good, getting past. And we knew that the new wind system was coming from the west. So we had got past Madeira, picked up the new wind before the other bunch, sailed into La Rochelle, heroes welcome, hurrah, brilliant, right? I was the 3rd of the 3 boats. I could see the other 2. I could see one just there, and then I can see one just on the horizon, just further up. And as we sail along sweetly, and there's white horses in the water, we're doing about 7 or 8, 9 knots. And then suddenly, it stopped. The wind died completely. The speed dropped to 0. And you're thinking, quick, let's get out of here. But you can't because you've got no momentum. But the other 2 boats carried on. And what had happened was that the wind shadow from the island had bounced off the sea. And it created a secondary wind shadow at 45 miles, just where I was. So for 16 hours, we were caught individually in our own private little wind shadow.
That's crazy.
At one stage, there was a super tanker coming towards us. And I called him up on the radio and said, look, super tanker, 200,000 tons of oil in a thin steel membrane. Could you move out the way? Because if I move out the way, I've got to start the engine and then I've got to retire.
You're not allowed to start the engine.
No, not at all. And he very kindly said he'd try, which was good. But anyway, the damage was done. So now we came out of that wind, but now we missed the weather that everyone else had. So as they stormed up the coast of Africa and past the entrance of the Med doing 10, 12 knots, all we could do is pick up the crumbs under the table. And we were becalmed off Cape Finisterre. And it got to a stage where we ran out of food. And the only thing we had left was porridge.
And Tabasco.
And there's only so many ways that you can eat porridge. And we make little fritters out of it, anything you want, and with Tabasco. And so
We were frying porridge,
like porridge fritters with Tabasco.
That's so crazy.
Anything's palatable with Tabasco. So yeah, that was a shame. Instead of coming in first, we actually did have to retire from the leg. One of my crew was a bit poorly, running out of medication, ran out of food. We're running out of time to start the last leg.
So the last leg starts at a fixed time, right?
Yeah.
So the longer you leave it, the less recovery time you've got in life.
Absolutely right. And you've got to get in to do the final start. So it was a fascinating concept of creating a joint motivation, because this was now a profound decision. It wasn't just mine as the leader. It belonged to the team as well, because they'd invested 9 months of their life into this race. Where I painted the picture that we wouldn't get into La Rochelle in time to start the last leg of the race, which means we wouldn't get back to Southampton with the rest of the fleet. Which means we're not going to finish with everybody, the helicopters, the champagne, the fireworks, the families. And so we all agreed, no, we've got to leave La Rochelle at the same time. So, okay, good. You come to a common point, which is a lovely point in conflict resolution.
Yeah, which is great, isn't it?
So let's find the common point.
Own the decision.
Because some people said, yeah, I want to sail around the world. And others said, let's stop now. Get into La Rochelle, prepare ourselves, and win the last leg. And then we thought, okay, so if we got to start, how many hours preparation do we need? Everyone else is already in there enjoying the hospitality of France. We're eating porridge in Tabasco. And we agreed that we didn't reach a certain point, but a certain time, we'd have to put on the engine and go in. And that time did arrive, but we got to the point where, and I was lucky, we videoed some key bits. It's a beautiful story. But we had to put on the engine. We radioed ahead to say, look, team large, on the Olympic group, we're going to retire from leg six with intent to win leg seven, the final leg of the race. We're motoring in at top speed towards La Rochelle. And what was lovely was, as we approached it, the empathy and understanding for everyone else, this whole fleet of boats came out to meet us, throwing food at us, pizzas, bananas, beer, the whole lot. We were bloody starving.
That's brilliant.
And then when we get into the harbour, there's hundreds of people in the docksides in La Rochelle, and there's a television crew there, so Che Blythe and all these dignitaries, and the boat comes alongside, and just as we part the boat and put the ropes on, my team throw me in the water. They jump in after me. Someone throws in a few cases of beer. And there's my team treading water in the harbour of La Rochelle, drinking beer, singing our team song. And there's a French reporter who's talking to Sir Che Blythe. He goes, excuse me, Sir Che, I'm confused.
So these come in first?
They come in last, yes.
Yeah,
and
Che
said,
right,
they came in last. They're bloody useless. And all the French guy could say was, mon Dieu, what do they do when they win?
Oh, that's funny. And what happened in
there? Well, the final leg back was amazing because it was... Che is a showman. He wanted the boats to arrive Saturday afternoon, primetime TV. So it doesn't matter how fast you were going. He's going to put a series of marks all around the English Channel. And if you look at the journey we took, it was quite dog-led. But what was amazing was, as we came around the bottom of the Isle of Wight for the very last time, there's six boats fighting for first place. We're in there. We came into Poole Harbour, chasing across Poole Harbour back towards the Solent. Now only five boats chasing for the lead. We were there. Coming into the Narrows through Hurst and the Solent, four boats chasing for the lead. And for 1, 2, 3, and 4 finished within 2 minutes of each other. So having been last and out of the race, we were right up there competitive. We've crossed the line in fourth place, seconds behind the leaders. And it was a real strong point for us as team large, as we were known on this boat, that we wanted to prove to the world, actually, we are bloody good.
Amazing.
We can do stuff. And not only did we recover with a lot less preparation, but we pushed hard right to the end. It was beautiful. Lovely finish.
Manly, thank you so much for talking to me. And hopefully our listeners have got a good, strong view of what compassionate leadership is. And
hopefully.
I really appreciate your time.
Taking a few 23 minutes and 7 minute breaks on the way, then that's great. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
What you guys are doing at the Do Lecture.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Do Podcasts with me, Gav Thompson. Thank you so much for listening. Please do leave me a review and subscribe, or email me with any comments, gav@thedolectures.co.uk. Episodes are released every other Friday. This podcast was produced by George McDonough, with music by James Motton.